Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, set up to help people with cancer understand and access their options within integrative medicine. These are very concerning times and they brought new stresses to add to the many that people with cancer already face. In response, we're doing all we can to provide additional support at Yes to Life, primarily via our helpline service. So if you're one of these people, do keep in touch. But meanwhile, we're all trying to keep as many aspects of general life afloat as we can, and although public attention is inevitably focused on the progress of COVID-19, one of the world's most authoritative figures on the state and progress of oncology, Ralph Moss, has released a new book that is highly critical of every level of drug development for cancer and brings a perspective that is a stark contrast to the media hype we've all become accustomed to. I'm talking to Ralph about Cancer Incorporated over Skype in the US. Hi Ralph, I'm really excited to have this opportunity to talk about your new book.
Thank you, Robin. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
So, unbelievably, the book that first really lifted the lid on the cancer establishment, the cancer industry, came out 40 years ago. So, I didn't get to read it until 2005. That was the first year that Yes to Life was in existence. And although I already knew that things were not exactly all well within oncology, it was one massive eye-opener for me. I still remember looking at that page of conflicts of interest for Memorial Sloan Kettering and just being absolutely gobsmacked. How did this happen?
Yeah.
Anyway, you've now got what you call a long view of cancer medicine, and I just want to hear, in your opinion, 4 decades later, has the overall situation got better or worse?
It's, in my opinion, it's much worse.
Right.
Much worse than what shocked you in cancer industry 40 years ago.
Mm.
And I'd say it would be like comparing what the cancer business has become. It'd be like comparing a shack in 1980 to a skyscraper in 2020.
Mm.
And more importantly, it's not just the size of the industry, which is $120 billion per year for cancer drugs alone, but it's the absolute control that the largest pharmaceutical companies, Big Pharma, now exerts over the oncology profession, I think, and the public at large, but primarily over the oncology profession, which is the gatekeeper to the treatments, because very few people initiate a course of treatment on their own. You can't legally, you can't do that. You'd have to find a doctor who would agree with you, which becomes more and more difficult to do. So there is a absolute strangulation on innovation in cancer treatment coming from outside a very narrow circle.
Mm-hmm.
And the oncology profession has been in its leadership, the key opinion leaders has been bribed. I won't sugarcoat this.
Okay.
They've been bribed and corrupted by Big Pharma, which primarily means 9 firms that control most of the new cancer drugs in the world, and these companies, individually and to a certain degree collectively, have manipulated every phase of the drug approval and information and legislative and regulatory process in order to guarantee tremendous super profits that they are reaping from the use of these drugs.
Mm. Well, I just read today that their profits are twice of any other sector.
wouldn't surprise me.
That underlines it.
And what this means for the consumer, especially in the United States, but also for the UK, which I think has been, in a way, been exemplary worldwide for resisting the pressure of the of these big pharma companies. But in, here in the U.S., because of a provision put into law in 2003, the main governmental agencies that purchase drugs, that's mainly Medicare, which is health, you know, health care for people over 65, and Medicaid, which is for people who are poor, too poor to afford their own their own, fulfill their own prescriptions, and also for the Veterans Administration, they are by law, federal law, not allowed to negotiate the price of drugs. They don't set the price of drugs. The price is entirely set by the company itself, with no input to, that I'm aware of from the government. And then they the government has to pay the price that's set by the by the company, and is not allowed to negotiate. Whereas in Britain, as in many other countries, most other countries, I would imagine, you have a process by which the government judges the actual value of the drug, and then negotiates with the company over the price, which is many times far, far less than it is for the American, where the consumer has to then pick up the price of that either through payments out of their own pocketbook, or else their insurance company or Medicare has to pay that price.
That's what you call being over a barrel, I think.
Absolutely over a barrel.
And what a person who's truly representing the public in government would ever make a law like that? Only a corrupted one, I think.
I just want to say Robin,
that
an interesting little factoid is that that law, like many laws, all the laws really that pertain to the pharmaceutical industry, was influenced by somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 lobbyists from the drug industry working the halls of Congress in advance of the passage of that law. So we have about, I forget the number, let's say we have about 500 congressmen and senators. I don't know, I don't remember the exact number.
Right.
So you can imagine that within, if everybody was, if every congressman was present, there were three drug company lobbyists for each and every member of the Congress. The law passed in a surprise vote at 3 o'clock in the morning, called by the Republicans, and it passed by one, by a single vote. Because of that single vote majority at three in the morning, a surprise vote, we have been saddled for the last 17 years with a system that generates billions, tens of billions of dollars for the drug companies, because they get to charge whatever they might want. And I think for your listeners, it might come as because of your very different, and I think in many ways very far superior way of handling these problems in the UK. It might come as a surprise for how much people are forced to pay to get these drugs. So let me just give you a very quickly a few examples. So the immune checkpoint inhibitor drugs that we'll talk some more about, they average about $150,000 per patient for the just for a single drug. Now we're seeing drugs that are more like $200,000 per patient. And there's one drug called Kymriah. That's a it's a form of cellular therapy, so it takes a lot more work, more effort, more skill to make that drug. But Kymriah sells for $475,000 per infusion.
Per infusion? Oh my God! Not
per
even per
infusion.
Patient.
And the drug was invented by a doctor named Carl June at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's written that the actual cost for producing this drug, it's a living drug, if you will, it's a cellular preparation that works on the immune system, but the actual cost, he says, is $20,000. I don't know if I believe that it's that much, but think about the implications of that.
Yeah.
$20,000 to produce, $475,000 is the retail price that basically everybody has to pay, or their insurance company or the drug or the government has to pay one way or another. The cost, the company makes that much money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at 95% markup, and there's nothing under current law, there's nothing that the government or anybody else can do about that.
Nuts. Absolutely nuts. So look, things have been getting steadily worse, obviously, in the last 40 years. But what in particular was it that prompted you to want to revisit this topic right now, go through all the enormous effort of producing a book again on this subject?
Right. So I run a company called Moss Reports. We make reports for cancer patients, and I do some consultations for cancer patients. So we're always looking to see what are the most pertinent topics. That we do a lot of other reports. You were kind enough to discuss our booklet, the Do-It-Yourself Guide to Cancer Treatment, last year. So we were looking, my son and I are in business together, we were looking for another topic that we could do a free report on, and we decided to do something about the clinical trial structure. Mm-hmm. What it is, should patients go into clinical trials? If they go into clinical trials, what to look for, what to watch out for, and so forth. So that was the actual genesis of the topic just about this time last year. And I started to work on that. And I had certain preconceived notions, let's say, about the clinical trial system. But as I got into it, I realized that the clinical trial system was being manipulated by the drug companies in order to come out with positive seeming results. So far we've said nothing about the effectiveness of the drugs, and I'm sure that some listeners might think, well, it's a pity that they're charging so much, but at least the drugs work, right? I mean, at least they do what they claim to do, or else the FDA or the European Medicines Agency or other regulatory agencies wouldn't have approved them. How could that be? And so as I delved into this topic more, I realized a couple of things. One of them is that the clinical trials, which are the foundation stone of all modern medicine, especially the randomized controlled trial, that's the crown jewel, some people call it, of the whole drug testing apparatus. And I realized that these were being tilted, being prejudiced towards a positive result in a number of ways. And one of those was by cherry picking the patients.
Mm-hmm.
This means that if you choose, let's say, from about, let's say, 5% of the patient population, you choose the people more likely to be healthy, more likely to be well off financially, to be urban, to go to comprehensive cancer centers, big cancer centers, to be in the Caucasian, if you will, white portion of the population, not members of minority groups, and to be young. That's also very important. So the net effect of that is that you have this select group of healthier people that the drugs are being tested on. And then you report out on the effectiveness and the side effects and the tolerability of the drug based upon results in that cherry-picked population. But then you get down to the regular people, the real world, as it's called even in the scientific publications,
yes,
which represents in the U.S. 85% of the population. So 15% would be people who go to the large comprehensive cancer centers, and 85% are people who just go to the local oncology department or outpatient department or what have you, and they are treated in a different way. And they represent a different group because the cancer is, to a good extent, it's a disease of older people mm-hmm. over 65. Most cancer deaths occur in people over 75. And the tolerance for these drugs is much less in that group. So at the very least, people drop out of the studies or out of the treatment, or they have to interrupt their treatment, or they can't take the same maximum tolerated dose that's used in a lot of the protocols. So the short answer is that the results achieved in clinical trials don't really apply to 85% or so of the population. That's one way that they skew the right results. Another way that they do this is, it's a very, very subtle but very important point. They redefine the word survival so that it means something that that I would say 99 out of 100 people would never recognize.
Right.
Meaning that for you or for me or for your listeners, survival, we have a common sense notion of what survival it means. If you say that a drug it will increase your survival, you think quite logically that you're going to live longer. But that is not the case, because most of the time when they talk about survival being increased by cancer drugs, they are talking about progression-free survival. There's actually a dozen definitions of the word survival at the National Cancer Institute website. Mm-hmm. And only one of those is the one that would correspond to the common sense view, which is the increase in the median overall survival. Overall survival is real survival. It means starting from this point where you start your treatment, you're going to live longer if you take the drug than if you don't take the drug.
Right.
Most of the time, that's not what they mean by increased survival. What they mean is that there's a length of time within which the doctor cannot diagnose the disease as progressing, meaning growing worse. And that period of time is called the progression-free interval. So let's say you have two people. One, and they're both starting on day one, and they both die on day 1 year later, day 365. Okay, so one of them basically goes along for till the six-month point, and there's no sign of the disease progressing. But then the disease recurs on the six-month point observation, and then the patient dies at the one-year mark. Now, that's patient number one. Patient number two, who gets a different drug or no drug at all, basically the disease continues to progress. It progresses along a little bit different curve, but he or she also dies at the one-year mark.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them started treatment on the same day. Both of them died on the same day. But when it comes to recording the results of the treatment, they will record that there was a six-month increase in progression-free survival for the first patient and no increase in progression-free survival for the second patient.
Mm.
So this looks quite different. But actually, from the patient point of view, it wasn't really any better. In fact, it might have been worse if they took a drug that caused a lot of side effects,
right,
and then they died with no benefit. But from the point of view of the drug company and the FDA, which has also in its own way been corrupted by the drug industry, something highly beneficial happened. Six-month increased, quote, survival. And it's on that basis, I would say in about half the cases, that they would get approval based upon an increased, quote-unquote, survival. There was no increased survival. There was an increase in the interval within which the doctors couldn't see the cancer progressing.
So this is the world of surrogate endpoints, which I think is poorly understood Correct. By the public. But they really do need to get to grips with it, because it's kind of a dodgy yeah. language that doctors and researchers are using, which, the public don't understand it. And so they're being hoodwinked, essentially, into thinking they're getting a benefit when they're not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't forget, those were the cherry-picked patients.
Yes.
So the average consumer is being told, you're going to get a benefit that isn't a real benefit, or certainly not nothing more than maybe a psychological lift for the first 6 months that they thought the drug was working. And secondly, they probably statistically don't fall into that category of the cherry-picked patient population, so they're probably not going to get that supposed benefit anyway.
Right.
And yet, you could take a drug and spin straw into gold, as it were, because you take a drug and you make a fake image of it being beneficial, and then you sell that to the oncology profession, which then sells it to the patient population. Plus, you sell it directly in the United States and one other country, New Zealand. You can advertise these results directly to the consumer.
Right.
And Americans watch hours. The average American, at least the ones who watch television, and even those who get their news from the internet, is subjected to numerous, many-fold advertisements for drugs. And, of course, with more targeted advertising, cancer patients are likely to see a lot of these ads.
Yes.
And basically the patients are then becoming enmeshed in the sales force of the drug company, because they're oftentimes desperate and they're very vulnerable, and they see these ads, some of which are truthful, some of which are deceptive. But very often it's the patient now who initiates the demand for the drug, and bypassing the doctor, who's just flooded with requests for a drug that maybe they know, they understand that this drug isn't likely to help, but they become a bad doctor, get a bad rating if they don't give the patient the drug that the patient wants, even though that's based more often than not on an illusion. So yeah, it's really quite a system. I mean, from a kind of diabolical, but everything evolved over the period of the last 40 or 50 years and more, I would say, because I have a penchant for history and for going back and looking at what the origin of things are. And yes. I see the origin of this in the formation of the war on cancer in 1971. Richard Nixon's famous war on cancer.
Yeah,
I see the origins of it. The problem was already there, as I explain in my book. So, but nothing like I didn't really glimpse. I didn't. I only glimpsed the beginning of it. That's what you were referencing, because I worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and when I looked into who directed that center, I found more often than not that the key people were either executives of big pharmaceutical companies or were serving as directors of pharmaceutical companies, the so-called interlocks between the top cancer warriors, and the drug industry was already starting in the 1970s, but it hadn't reached this gargantuan proportions, and it is a scandal. It's so huge that you hardly know where to begin. And I wrote the book basically to try to call it the public's attention to this. And I want to say also, Robin, that we decided to give away the book rather than try to sell it. We are giving away the book free without any charge. Anybody in the world who goes to our website, mossreports.com/cancerincorporated or Cancer Inc. would also work. And you just, you can download the, because I just feel like this is information that has to get out as broadly as possible, because a few people knowing this, it'll be, you know, easily dismissed. It's only if we can energize people by the thousands to understand what's happening to us that we're going to get anywhere in opposing or stopping this.
Right. Well, good plan. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, talk about a dystopian world. We have the Cancer Act in the UK from 1939, which ostensibly is to stop quacks and people advertising that they can treat cancer. You know, there you have on a massive scale, basically quackery being advertised to the entire American public. You know, it would be funny if it wasn't so absolutely horrendous.
Right. One of the characteristics of a quack, according to the famous poster that I reproduce in Cancer Incorporated, was that the quack advertises to the public.
Right.
This is now generalized. All the drug companies that I'm aware of advertise to the public, advertise their wares. Their excuse, of course, would be to hide behind the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, approval, so they're not advertising things that FDA hasn't approved. But then we have to look into how do these approvals come about. And I would call your listeners' attention to a couple of websites that could give some insight into this. There's a website of the U.S. government called Open Data, and you can just search for Open Data, and it's part of the Health and Human Services, or Medicare, basically. And this was a part of what was called the Sunshine Act. It was one of the things that the Obama administration did that I heartily approve of, which was to require drug companies to disclose to the penny how much money they were giving to American doctors and who they were giving it to. How much of that money went for research? How much of it was in the form of stocks or stock options? And how much of it was what was called general funds, which I think is a euphemism, because what it really means is how much went directly into the pocket of the particular researcher. And what I found was, and this is an amazing site, and what I found was that if you look at the key studies, that's to say the clinical trials that led to the approval of a particular drug coming from Big Pharma, I didn't find any instances in which the key opinion leaders, the key people who were the first author, the second author, the final author, senior author, in which they were not on the take, basically, from Big Pharma. And meaning that if you look at the general payments, which are for things, very ill-defined things like honoraria, right, or speakers bureau, or different kinds of promotional talks to doctors or to the public, or writing articles, putting their names on articles, basically, that are written by the drug industry, which is a much more common practice than most people realize. But it's hard to find instances in which people are not taking considerable amounts of money. We know because it was exposed on the front page of the New York Times about a year and a half ago that the then physician in chief of Memorial Sloan Kettering took about $3 million from drug companies, particularly one particular drug company that he was touting their products. I mean, this came to people's attention because he had declared that he had no conflict of interest.
Yeah.
He must have had a peculiar definition of conflict of interest, because $3 million, I think, definitely constitute a conflict of interest. Now, I did find instances in which key doctors were not taking money. So And I, two in particular that that stand out in my mind. One, I don't have to name the names, but one of them is a head of a department at Memorial Sloan Kettering who has been highly critical of Big Pharma's corrupting influence. Mm-hmm. And he I don't think he took any money, or I don't think a few hundred dollars doesn't constitute, you know, a bribe. And then also another scientist who is actually a Nobel laureate, who I think his payment amounted to a couple of $100, which is nothing, because it just means, oh, I took somebody out to dinner and it turned out that that person was working for a drug company and I paid for the dinner. One of his charges to the drug industry was $23.64. Right. He listed that as his pay. So I think there are honest people out there, and I'm not saying that the majority of oncologists are corrupted. They're not, but I think out of fear or complacency, or maybe some of them are hoping themselves to rise, you know, to the position of being a key opinion leader, they tolerate this. So you have this corruption going on within the ranks of oncology, within the leadership, that with rare, well, I've never seen it rise to the level of a public dispute about this, you know, for the obvious reasons. When your livelihood is at stake, you know, you hesitate to take moves that could, you won't be able to pull back, you know. There isn't much opposition within oncology to this, so the whole profession is corrupted, whether it's actively involved in taking payments or passively allowing others to get these payments without raising objections to it. And I think that the whole profession is really is in moral danger, as it were, because they have tolerated this, and it amounts to many, many hundreds of millions of dollars. And again, you can go to the U.S. government website. I can't give you the exact address, but it's called Open Data. It comes from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, and it's quite blatant and out there. They're not technically not hiding it anymore, but because it's publicly available.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and the equivalent to look at, which is much better known, would be Open Secrets, which is an .org website. And Open Secrets tracks the payments going from different industries, lobbyists and different industries, to the U.S. Congress. And it's also quite educational, not governmental, but it's just a non-governmental organization. And they it also shows, if you specify pharmaceutical industry, medical industry, and then choose particular Congress people, you see how much money is flowing in campaign donations, which is their euphemism for bribes. Yeah. And so you want to know why they passed the law that the government can't negotiate over the price of drugs. It's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're on the take. And this has become our reality, that our government now is more or less bought and paid for by industry. The head of all the health and human services in the U.S. government is the former CEO of the Eli Lilly drug company, one of the big in North American pharmaceutical companies.
Yep.
And that's just emblematic.
And
more than half of the employees of the Food and Drug Administration, when they leave FDA, they become what are called revolvers, and that means that they go from the FDA to the drug company. Oftentimes, the drug company that they were overseeing, that they were responsible for the approval of their products, and then there's just this revolving door, because from there they can go back into government service at a higher level. And from government service, they go back to the pharmaceutical industry, around and around and around it goes. And I forget how many, I think I saw the figure 57%, or I'm just quoting from memory, of the lobbyists are former FDA employees. Right. So they're getting the approval and constantly whittling down the requirements for of testing, always in the direction of, let us give you a surrogate marker. You mentioned the term surrogate marker. Let us give you some non-meaningful measurement of supposed benefit as opposed to actual benefits. So this is how they've rigged the system.
Incredible story. So look, when you wrote The Cancer Industry, it was kind of the era of chemotherapy, and you actually wrote a separate book just to address that particular form of treatment. But since then, we've been through all sorts of other things, which, of course, the media have been on like mad, targeted therapies, immune checkpoint inhibitors, all these things that people don't necessarily understand, but they've certainly heard all about them because they're such amazing breakthroughs. So this book, your new book, you're not exactly enthusiastic about the progress that's been made through these new eras. Do you want to just summarize what you think has happened?
Sure. So starting from about the 1990s on, there was a pivot away from cytotoxic chemotherapy, standard chemotherapy, to more targeted types of treatments. And the basic premise of this was that cancer was a genetic disease, and as such, one could identify the mutation within the cancer and then target that, meaning direct a little guided missile towards that. That either would hit the product of the gene, the key product, and be able to identify the cancer in that way, maybe attach a little poison to the tip of that that guided missile, and so more intelligently just kill cancer cells and leave normal cells alone. And this was spelled, elaborated tremendously. The deciphering of the human genome, of course, was a key point. And then in 2011, the development of what's called next generation sequencing, which is a high throughput type of system where you can do a lot of these sequences at the same time, which brought the cost of sequencing the genes of the cancer down to in the range of $5,000 or $6,000. Originally, the goal was to make it about $1,000. But anyway, it's within reach of the government and consumers, supposedly. In our country, Medicare pays for about half of that, and so the individual consumer would be out maybe about $3,000 to have the genome tested. And the government, the U.S. government in the Obama era, put its stamp of approval on this type of treatment through something called the Precision Medicine Initiative and the Cancer Moonshot, and there was an enormous amount of money that was allocated for this. And you've heard, even in the current campaign cycle, both ex-Vice President Biden and President Trump, before everybody's attention diverted to COVID-19, but they were talking about how they were going to cure cancer and in their tenure. And what they're referring to is the so-called precision medicine initiative.
Right.
So but what I get to in the book is that, with rare exceptions, this doesn't work. We can see it both theoretically and practically. So theoretically, there are many more mutations within cancer than were dreamed of back 20 or 25 years ago, even 10 years ago. And a lot of this work, by the way, was done in the UK at Cambridge. So Michael Stratton and others at the Genome Project there, and also, of course, in the US as well, at the NIH and the National Cancer Institute. So what they discovered was that there are numerous mutations within most cancers, and how many there are and how often that occurs is a matter of dispute. But it seems as if the numbers of mutations within cancer only increases as the time goes by. So at the very least, I would say three quarters of the cancers are just highly mutated, and only about a quarter. And this is being the most optimistic. Sometimes when you have a single mutation, like the so-called Philadelphia chromosome, which is a mutation that involves the movement of genes from one chromosome to another, like a switching of genes on chromosomes. And there is a drug called Gleevec that one of the things it does is target that mutation. So that did seem to work quite well in a number of relatively uncommon cancers. And that happened about 20 years ago. And so and it made the cover of Time magazine and so forth. So right. We've been sort of running off of that success ever since then. But right. If you look at the attempts being made to basically devise treatments solely based upon the genetic profile of cancers, just like we won't worry about where the cancer originated, which is traditionally you worry about what organ it arose in and what the extent of the disease is and how malignant the cells appear under the microscope and so forth. But instead of worrying about that, some people had the idea, well, let's just go for the mutation, go straight to the mutation. So they would find a group of people who had the same mutation and give a drug against that mutation. Mm-hmm. Well, there are about three large clinical trials underway with that. It just hasn't worked.
Right.
I would say just it isn't over yet, because enormous sums of money have been invested in this and enormous hopes are invested in this and so forth. But it is an unproven theory. And I'd say the early indications are that doesn't work. And so there's a couple of possible reasons for that. One of them is if you target a mutation, a particular mutation, well, there probably are other mutations out there that you're not targeting. So you could think of these as pathways, growth pathways. Yes. If you block one growth pathway, the cancer adjusts and it goes down a different pathway.
Right.
So that's one reason. Another thing is that cancers are just highly mutated, highly mutable. You can't really give too many of these drugs because unlike the dream of 20, 25 years ago, it just isn't the case that these are non-toxic agents. Perhaps they're less toxic than standard chemotherapy, but that doesn't make them non-toxic enough to be able to give them in combinations. And you won't find many many combination therapies of targeted drugs. You'll find combinations of chemo plus targeted drugs, but the contribution of the targeted drug is not very great usually. Mm. And the trials are not working out well. And I give all the details in Cancer Incorporated. If anybody, you know, whoever is interested in this could look at that and see why I say that. The other thing is that cancer may not be a genetic disease. And I raise this, I have a chapter on metabolic therapy and the thinking of Thomas Seyfried at Boston College, as well as the folks at the Care Oncology Clinic in London, and Jay McClellan, who's written the book How to Starve Cancer. This is a school of thought. It's not a very small one either. There's a lot of adherence to this more in the lay public than in the scientific community, but it's a perfectly plausible argument. And I did have Thomas Seyfried's help in writing this the chapter on this in my book, and I think he raises very good points that have been neglected and ignored for the obvious reason that it's like doubting the existence of God in medieval Europe.
Yes, you know? You're right. Perfect.
You know, the first sentence, or one of the key sentences in the National Cancer Institute textbook on online textbook on cancer, the first sentence is, cancer is a genetic disease.
Right.
So, you know, and God is in his heaven and all's right with the world, you know. It's stated with similar assurance. Well, there are some reasons to believe that cancer is not a genetic disease, that cancer is a metabolic disease. So without going into excessive detail, what that means is that if there are thousands and thousands and thousands of genes and potential gene targets and combinations of genes, Metabolism is a much simpler concept. Basically, what that means is that in Professor Seyfried's view, that cancer originates not in the nucleus of the cell, but in a different part of the cell, meaning the mitochondria. The mitochondria are the energy factories of the cell, and these can either be damaged or diminished by carcinogens, basically, by environmental factors, possibly also by some genetic factors could also diminish the mitochondria. But mostly what he's talking about is the environmental stress on the mitochondria, which could also be poor choices in terms of food, excessive consumption of sugar, and so forth. But we're not talking here about what the cause of cancer, but the initiation, whatever it is that initiates the cancer, could happen at the level of the mitochondria. And once you mess up the mitochondria, then the genetic changes in the nucleus follow as a result of the attack on the mitochondria, rather than the change happening at the level of the genes, which then impact the mitochondria, which is the standard theory.
Right.
So it seems almost, you know, like metaphysical.
Yes.
The distinction. Most cancer patients couldn't care less about where it occurred. They just want to know how to cure it. But it actually, this is a case in which theory, basic medical theory, turns out to be of enormous consequences. Because where are you going to address your treatment? Because most of these drugs are targeted against the nucleus of the cell or abnormal proteins created by genes within the nucleus. That can be all just the downstream effect.
Yes.
Of changes.
Symptom.
And if you want to address the metabolism of the cell, we know a little bit about that. One, it can be done with both diet and with simpler drugs. So the diet would it probably incline towards the same kind of diet that's used for type 2 diabetes. That's a long discussion, and
sure
we don't want to have that discussion now. But and I don't think there's one simple answer. I just say that it probably would mean greatly diminishing refined carbohydrates. Yeah. I think everybody agrees on that.
Right.
And
right.
As far as the drugs go, we have drugs that beneficially impact metabolism, the most striking of which is metformin. And metformin is a drug. It's originally was derived from an herb. It turns out that the drug is less toxic than the herb, so the drug was basically invented in order to get the benefit of the herb without the side effects of the herb. An unusual reversal of
very unusual.
But metformin is one of the best known drugs in the world. It's it's on the UN essential medicines list, and it has great potential as an anti-cancer agent because it works at the level of the mitochondria.
Right. Fascinating. Look, Ralph, we're just about out of time. I just wanted to, for the people interested in the metabolic theory, I thought it was fascinating to read in your book that Gleevec changes the respiration of cells from fermentation to normal, and so it might not be doing anything like what they think. I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
Or it does both. You know, it could be directly affecting the metabolism. Yes, my guess is that it's mostly about the metabolism.
Yeah. So just very quickly now, I mean, after delivering what should really be a fatal blow to the edifice of modern cancer treatment, you finish off with a list of 17 steps needed to fix cancer care. The fact that there are 17 is a kind of testament to the desperate place we're in. But what do you think are the chances of a significant proportion of these occurring anytime soon?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on what happens in society in general. It's not going to be because of my book. My book hopefully will make a contribution to this, but I would say that there are two elements to this. One is end the corruption within the oncology profession, within the Congress, within the FDA. Now that was, of course, key to the progressive agenda in the recent U.S. primaries. I'm not saying that that's dead and gone, but you know, obviously that's all on hold right now.
Right.
But there's an enormous public pressure building to to clean up the situation in Washington. That's the first thing.
Right.
The second thing is I call for, and I wrote this section in conjunction with Wayne Jonas, who was formerly head of the Office of Alternative Medicine at the National Institutes of Health, and so I could say we call for reforming the clinical trial process so that it eliminates those two sources, mainly the two sources of false results being reported, the cherry picking of patients. We want to see the patient population look like and reflect the clinical trial patient population should reflect the actual real world patient population.
Right.
And then we also call for nationalizing the cancer drug industry, which upsets a lot of my libertarian friends.
Yep.
And I mean, quite literally. But I don't see any other way that we're going to get this situation in hand unless we make the NIH and the NCI and the equivalents in other countries not only the developers of the drugs, because they are the developers of the drugs. Most of the work on developing new drugs occurs at the governmental level at taxpayers' expense, but also be in charge of the production of the drugs and the marketing, which means that they could farm this out to manufacturers to drug companies, but take the decision making and the development and the marketing and the pricing completely out of the hands of the drug industry. Because I don't think that cancer life and death is a matter of commerce.
Absolutely.
I think it's a matter of public good. And so some things are done better with a purely capitalist model, and some things are done better with a socialist model. And I think healthcare falls more into the realm of what I would call the socialized or the social, if you want to say socialist or socialized or nationalized realm, because at least you're then eliminating the profit motive as the driving force within the development of drugs. So the reason for the corruption disappears. And now you've got other problems, of course, you have bureaucracy and so forth, but at least there's the potential for bringing this into the public sphere where we can bring it out into the open and argue over public policy, not the shadowy way in which these drugs are promoted purely for the financial benefit of the owners of the companies and the directors of the companies. So that's our most radical proposal. And, you know, I've had people who have been enormously excited about my book, but that last bit is like the chicken bone that's
right.
Stuck in their throat. You know,
yeah.
I can't help it. So that's where my conclusion would be. But I'm open to hear any argument for how you think you can get to the same place that we all want to get to, the world without cancer, without the government stepping in and actually producing these drugs. And will that happen? I have a suspicion that it will, simply because we're already confronting this other crisis, this COVID-19
yes.
crisis, that is creating just sort of incredible pressure to have the government step in more and more and take
yes.
over these functions that are matters of life and death. We're fighting this out as we speak
yes.
in the United States, but I think it's going to ultimately, if we want to survive, it's going to have to be by the basically acknowledging healthcare as a human right and then proceeding from there.
Right. Okay. Well, look, I got to the end of your book and I was yes when I heard that, when I read that
yeah.
bit. So I completely agree with you, Ralph. Look, it's brilliant to talk
okay.
to you about this. I'm really pleased. It's fantastic you've got a new book out. I'm sure it is going to make a difference. The last one certainly had a big impact in many sectors in just revealing an understanding of what's actually going on. And that's all we need is education, really, to make the changes. So enormously indebted to you for all your fantastic work. I've just scraped
thank
the surface
you.
Of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, but it was really great. So thanks a lot.
Well, we'll do it again, Robin. And also, I just want to remind people that they can get a free copy
yes.
of the book at mossreports.com/cancerinc or Cancer Incorporated.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ralph.
You're quite welcome. Talk again and stay well.
Ralph's book is a brilliant read, particularly if you still hold on to any sort of belief that the pharmaceutical industry is doing all it can to tackle cancer. As he said, the book is completely free, so not to be missed, especially as some of us have more time on our hands than usual at the moment. My very best wishes go out to you, your family and your friends at this extraordinary time. I hope you are able to get through without too much hardship. The Yes to Life show is, thankfully, a totally virtual effort, and so I'll be back as usual next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.